of his wife because she was childless. The Lord answered his prayer and his wife Rebecca became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" I'm sure every mother can relate to that, huh? Why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb and two peoples from within you, you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other and the older will serve the younger." When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red and his whole body was like hairy garment. So they named him Esau, which I'm sure he appreciated. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. You know, we'll stop right there. And you know, my wife and I recently had a boy, in case you didn't know that. Probably all do know that. We named him Jacob, not giving a whole lot of thought to what it means in the Bible. Yeah. And as I began to study it, I had a moment of remorse, and I felt bad for him. So we're going to call him Jake for the most part. You know, and Jacob's an interesting character. You know, he's given this name, and this name could mean a variety of things, but basically none of it's positive.
That's right.
It could mean the one who deceives. It's kind of a Hebrew idiom for that. Or a supplanter, one who kind of like shrewdly takes that which belongs to another. It's really a lose-lose for Jacob here. He's not given a positive name in the Bible. And to be honest, his character is not positive. He's one of these guys in the Bible where you think, really? Like, really God works through this guy? Like, really God's going to carry on the incredible promises he made through Abraham through him? You know, and it's an interesting thing, you know, and he truly lives up to his name, right? If you look a little further there in Genesis 25, verse 27 says, "The boys grew up and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob." Parenting advice, that's not a good idea. Right? Not a good idea. "Once when Jacob was cooking," there in verse 29, "some stew, Esau came in from the open country famished. He said to Jacob, 'Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished.' That is why he was also called Edom. Jacob replied, 'First, sell me your birthright.' 'Look, I'm about to die,' Esau said. 'What good is the birthright to me?' But Jacob said, 'Swear to me first.'" Basically, put it in writing. "So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright." You know, like a typical guy, he comes in and he's famished and he can see nothing other than his hunger. And Jacob seizes on that opportunity. He's a shrewd man. He's smart. He's very intelligent. You know, he's conniving, if you will. He's plotting. He's scheming. He knows what he wants. And he's willing to do whatever really is necessary in order to gain that. You know, and Esau becomes the brunt of that. And he steals away this birthright, and that was really, honestly, just getting started for Jacob. You know, if you look a little bit further in the life of these two young men, all right, jump to Genesis 27. You know, in Genesis 27, it's a kind of a somber scene. The dad is on his deathbed dying, and he wants to pass on the blessing to his oldest. And Jacob and his mother together, you know, plot to basically, now that they've taken the birthright, let's also take the blessing of the dying father. And there's this tragic scene where Jacob does that very thing. You know, he puts on, some special clothing to make himself seem like Esau. He goes and he deceives his father on his deathbed into thinking that he is Esau, and he gets the blessing. You know, Esau later comes in and obviously he's crushed and he's devastated. You know, in chapter 27, verse 35, Isaac tells Esau, he says, "Your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing." Esau said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? This is the second time he's taken advantage of me. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." I jump down to verse 41. It says, "Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, 'The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob.'" Jacob's mom is a bit of a helicopter parent, and she quickly sees Esau's Facebook status about wanting to kill his brother. Comes up with a plan, sends him away, you know, and he takes off and leaves, you know, for Esau to have kind of a cooling off period for about 20 years. But as Jacob leaves, you know, he leaves behind him just a trail of destroyed relationships. He's a man that's so self-absorbed, kind of so selfish, that he's willing to do whatever he needs to do within his own family to get what he wants. You know, and that kind of sums up our first point on the man that this man that is walking with God, sort of, right, named Jacob. You know, he was a lost soul. In that whole, you know, that whole section of his life, there's little, if any, mention of God. He's in the lineage of the great promises that God had made to Abraham, yet in the early years, there's really nothing. There's nothing about God. There's very little thought about God. There's nothing about his life that reflects God. You know, and it's a dangerous picture. Like I said, he's a damaged man, and he's causing damage. I've been reading a book lately by this guy, John Ortberg, and it's titled Soul Keeper. And he says here in this book, he said, "I always thought that a lost soul referred to the soul's destination, not its condition. But it's the condition that's the real problem. If a car no longer works, it doesn't matter much whether it ends up in a junkyard or the valet parking section of the Ritz-Carlton. We're not lost because we are going to wind up in the wrong place. We are going to wind up in the wrong place because we are lost." That's a very good insight, because a lot of times we think about, you know, our lives and we think purely about the destination, either heaven or hell. But the reality is we're all going to end up in one place or another because of who we are. Because of the state of our soul. You know, and the evidence of these things, and Jesus talks about this repeatedly, of look at the fruit of people's lives. You know, the evidence of where we're going to end up is really, it's obvious in our lives way before we ever arrive at our destination. You know, and you see this very clearly at this time in the life of Jacob. Like I said, he's got fractured relationships all around him. You know, the first point I want to put before you this morning to think about is just the reality that a life without God does not work. A life lived without God is this. Most of us are here and we came from fractured homes where people tried to live their lives devoid of God, and it just ends up a mess. You know, and it's funny because when you're growing up and you have a fractured family, you think your family's unique. Then you begin to meet other people and you listen to their stories and you realize, man, the world is full of broken lives, damaged family, damaged relationships. Because so often people just try to live their life devoid of God. And to be honest, if there is no God, Jacob is living his life exactly how he should live his life. But if there's no greater accountability, if there's no greater oversight for the life of Jacob, then him doing whatever he's doing is actually probably pretty smart. It's in line with that paradigm. It's the idea of basically, socially, survival of the fittest. Do whatever I have to do to get ahead. It doesn't matter who I step on. It doesn't matter who I wound. It doesn't matter who I damage, even if they're my own family. But Jacob's reality is about to get expanded a whole lot. You know, he takes off and he begins to go on this journey. You know, and pick up here in Genesis 28. Verse 10 says, "Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth, with its top reaching to the heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. There above it stood the Lord. And he said, 'I am the Lord, the God of your father, Abraham, and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you, and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave until I have done what I have promised you.' When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, 'Surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it.' He was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven." Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed on his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel, though the city used to be called Luz. And Jacob made a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I'm taking, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God, and the stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth." You know, it's interesting that Jacob here, for the first time, sets off on his own. He leaves his father's household, he leaves the ruined relationships behind, and he's on a search for a wife, as most young men hopefully do at some point in their life. All right? And he begins this journey, you know, and he lays down and he has a sleep, and everything changes. His worldview is smashed, it's widened, it's opened. He realizes there's a lot more going on than he was ever aware of. That the first point that we had this morning is that life without God doesn't work. The second point is pretty obvious. It's that God is at work. We may want to live our life in a way that's devoid of Him, but the reality is, whether we are aware of it or not, God is at work. And he lays down and he has this incredible dream and this place. If you're reading a different Bible translation, there in verse 11, it says place three times. It's talking about this place. And this place that was ordinary, nothing special, all of a sudden in Jacob's mind, man, is the very house of God. And it's this idea that God takes something that's absolutely ordinary and quite mundane, nothing special about it, and he radically changes it. He radically transforms it. Simply with his presence. Simply by being there. But the reality is, for Jacob, is God has always been there. God has always been present. God has always been watching over him. God is fully aware of what he's done, where he's going, and why he's going. But God now has allowed Jacob to see that reality. You know, either way, you know, whether some Bible translations say that the Lord is standing at the base of the ladder, others say he's standing at the top. Either way, it doesn't really change it. The idea is that God is there. Right? That God is there and he is at work. The obvious truth of that story that the Bible, I think, wants us to understand is that God is present and active. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter in reality what you've done. Because Jacob's done nothing endearing at this point. He's done nothing that really draws you to him. He's done no deeds that we would look at and say, "Oh wow, he is so righteous." Nothing like that. When you look at Abram and you see him leave everything that he knew and go out on faith to a place where God doesn't even tell him where he's going. And right from the start with Abram, you're like, "Wow, that's incredible." Right at the start with Jacob, you're probably like, "What?" But it doesn't matter with God. God doesn't care where you've been and what you've done. He doesn't care about the mistakes you made. What he wants to do is change your future. And this story is a stark reminder that the spiritual world and the world we live in, you know what? They are not separate. They are actually actively connected to one another. That God is not distant, sitting in a cloud, unaware. No, he is omnipresent. And everything about our life may look like he's not there. But just as Jacob discovered there in verse 16, he's there and we often don't even realize it. The cool thing is that Jacob's life will never be the same. Yeah. And most of us are sitting here because we had a moment just like Jacob at some point in our lives. Yeah. You know, I remember that moment from my life. I remember as a university student off on my own realizing, you know what, I have messed up my life. And I began to think that surely God cares about what I'm doing. Surely God is not distant, but man, surely he can be found. You know, and my life changed at that moment. How I lived, my viewpoint, my philosophy, before I even opened the Bible, things were changing. Because this idea that God is there became a reality in my life. You know, and I'm willing to bet the same is for all of you. And if you're here for the first time, I want to encourage you to think about that truth. Yeah. That God is not distant, he is close. And the implications for that are profound. They can change the course of your life from this day forward. Turn with me to the New Testament. It's an interesting connection between the story of Jacob and the story in the Gospels. Turn to John chapter 1. In John chapter 1, Jesus has a conversation with another lost soul, and that guy's name is Nathanael. Verse 43 there, John 1, very end of the chapter. Find John 2 and you'll find John 1. It says, the next day Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law, about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." "Nazareth? Can anything good come from there?" Nathanael asked. "Come and see," said Philip. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, "Here truly is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." "How do you know me?" Nathanael asked. Jesus answered, "I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you." Then Nathanael declared, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus said, "You believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than that." He then added, "Very truly, I tell you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." It's an incredible tie-in between the old and the new. Nathanael is the opposite of Jacob. Jacob is a man full of deceit. His very name means the deceiver. But here's Nathanael, and the first thing Jesus says to him is, "Here's a man in whom there is no deceit." And Nathanael is skeptical of Jesus, but he comes and he takes the advice of his friend, and he comes and he sees, and he's amazed at the idea that God is present. I mean, Jesus tells him, "Hey, I saw you under the fig tree." It's a moment just like the story of Jacob where he realizes, God is here. I was not aware of it, but God was watching. I wasn't thinking about him, but yet there he was, searching for him in many ways. And Jesus, you know, is impressed with his response and gives him an incredible, incredible promise. He tells Nathanael, "You're going to see greater things than that. You think that's impressive? You're going to see angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Jesus is saying here, look, I'm the hub for what God is doing in this world. All the work of God will come through Jesus. All the ways that God will interact and change the world in which we live, the focal point of that, the center point of that, is Jesus. And for sure, Nathanael's life changes. He follows this man for 3 years, and his life will never be the same. You know, and the same is true for us, guys. Getting this truth to soak into our hearts that God is here changes everything. University of California, LA, UCLA, they did a research, one of these kind of, I don't know what you call them, psychological research projects. And they took two groups of 450 students, put them in two separate rooms, and they asked them, one group, to recall 10 books that they read during their high school years. And the other group, they asked them, "Hey, write down the 10 commandments." All right? And the way the two groups went about their task was radically different. The group that was looking at the books they read in high school, they cheated profusely. All right? It was open discussion, open comparative answers, all compiling a list that looked very similar to one another. The other group that was doing the 10 commandments, no one actually wrote down all 10 commandments, but no one cheated. And the researchers looked at that and think, if you just think about God, if you're just reminded that there may be a God, that it changes how you live your life. And like them, you probably won't always have the right answers, but how you live will be different. You'll live a life, perhaps, of integrity. You know, and this is very true of the life of Jacob. You know, Jacob's life doesn't change overnight. You know, he's on a journey to go find a wife, and he goes, and he meets this kind relative named Laban, who's not really a kind relative. And if you know the story, Laban deceives him. All right, Jacob has his eye on one of Laban's daughters. Laban has an idea to give him his other daughter. And for 7 years, you know, Jacob works trying to get that daughter, and, you know, the next day wakes up, that's not the right daughter. And he works 7 more years to get the one that he really wanted. 14 years. And he was deceived into it. I mean, how many times do you think he thought about that over those years? You know, what's his biggest problem? Deception. God's guiding him, and where does he leave him? To a man who deceives him. You know, and you think about the life of Jacob, and he finally gets the wife he wanted, and he works for 6 more years for Laban, and Jacob is still being deceptive. Right? He does some funny things with the animals, you know, making sure he basically stacking his flocks and giving all the weak ones to his father-in-law. And sure enough, where does that deception leave him? His brothers-in-law hate him. Now his own brother hates him. Back home with mom, you know, and now he's traveled and he hasn't really changed as much as he needs to change, and he's still having conflict. You know, but what we begin to see is that over these years, you know, perhaps God is breaking down these things in Jacob's life. Perhaps God is trying to force Jacob to look at things that he doesn't want to look at. To look at patterns of how he lives his life and see how flawed they are and how destructive they are. You know, and I think it's always humbling to look at these stories, because we read these stories and they're like 2 pages, 3 pages. And they're like 60 years of their life. When we look at snapshots. You know, and I think that in and of itself is a lesson for us on how God works. We want it now. We want change quickly. Right? But man, God works over time to mold us and to shape us. And I often wonder how much Jacob sat around and thought with regret about the choices he made as they were turned back on him. Because tragically, that's the only way a lot of times we learn. It's when we actually receive back how we've been to others, and then we're like, oh, that doesn't feel so good. You know, and it's a sad thing, because I think God wants us to learn the lesson without that. Yeah. But oftentimes, we don't learn lessons until we have the unpleasant thing of discipline in our life. You know, a good Christian artist is this woman, Sarah Groves. And one of her songs is called Less Like Scars. You know, one of the lyrics in there, it says, "And I feel you here, and you're picking up the pieces, forever faithful. It seemed out of my hands, a bad situation, but you are able. And in your hands, the pain and hurt look less like scars and more like character." You know, and she touches on this idea that you know what, when God is present, when we realize He's present, when we realize He's faithful, when we believe and know that He's there, the situations in life don't scar us like they did before. They change us. Because if you try to live your life devoid of God, hurt and hardship are of very little value to you. But if you believe in God, if you believe in a God who shapes your life like an artist with a painting, if you believe that that's how God works, that changes everything and how you respond. And if you look to the kind of the goodbye sequence here, Genesis 31. You know, as Laban and Jacob here are kind of, you know, burying the hatchet, if you will. Jacob, a man who talks very little of God, has a conversation here with Laban in verse 48, chapter 31. Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me today. That is why it was called Galeed. It was also called Mizpah, because he said, 'May the Lord keep watch between you and me when we are away from each other. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take any wives beside my daughters, even though no one is with us, remember that God is a witness between you and me.'" You know, Jacob turns around and does a similar oath. You know, as Laban and him, in many sense, resolve their issues. And they do it as two men with full belief that they stand before their Creator. He says, "Hey, no one's here except these rocks. And so let's remember these rocks as a witness, because God is here. We don't always physically see it, but man, we got to be reminded of that." And that idea that God is present, though we're alone, He will change us. You know, the third and last point I have this morning is that we are God's workmanship. We are God's workmanship. A life without God surely doesn't work. But the reality is that God is at work, And God's greatest task is changing us. He's always wanted to walk with that which He created. He did it in the beginning, and mankind drifted further and further and further from Him. And the further, you know, if you read Genesis and you look at the trajectory of Genesis, the further the Bible gets from Genesis, up through, you know, Genesis 1 to 11, the further they get from God, the more violent they become. The more they turn on one another and produce societies that are all about raising up self and not about glorifying God. You know, but like I said, you know, Jacob's been living now for about 20 years, fully aware that God is present. You know, and as he goes back to meet Esau, some things are very, very different. You know, turn with me here to Genesis 32. Come on. You know, Jacob is rightfully a little bit scared. He didn't part well with his brother. Like I said, his brother was tweeting about wanting to kill him once dad was dead. You know, in Genesis 32, you know, in the first part of this chapter, you know, he plots ways to kind of butter up his brother by sending everyone else in front with lots of gifts to try to, you know, grease the wheels, if you will. He sends everyone ahead, verse 21. So Jacob's gifts went on ahead of him, but he himself spent the night in the camp. Verse 22, it says, that night Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons and crossed the ford of Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all of his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When a man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. You know, and it's an interesting story, you know, and it's a story that's just chock full of meaning. You know, this man is introduced, and it's mystery. Who is this man that he's wrestling with all night? And as the story goes on, you know, the riddle is kind of peeled back, and the reality is that man is God. You know, and obviously from a Christian perspective, we look back on the story and we think, man, that's like a prefigure of Jesus. You know, and there's so many things in the story that point to that reality. You know, the man has a wrestling match with Jacob. And Jacob, when he realizes in hindsight he was wrestling with God, he's astonished that he didn't die. He's astonished that he saw God face to face and didn't die. And so this man that wrestled with Jacob showed him mercy. He didn't give him what he deserved, which was death. Jacob obviously deserved death. His life was full of fractured relationships that were a byproduct of his sin. And yet God showed him mercy. But God didn't just show him mercy. He wrestles, and what does it say? When the man couldn't overcome him. And so the man shows Jacob grace. I mean, the man touches him and dislocates his hip, right? I mean, why not do that like in round one of the fight, okay? You know, you've been wrestling all night and you don't do that until the end. He's letting him wrestle it out. He's letting him kind of get out his frustration. He's allowing him to rebel in some sense and not give in, but man, he's working on him and he's wearing him down. God showed him grace by letting him win. God takes his name, which means deceiver, and he changes it to Israel, which means struggles with God. He becomes this picture of what Israel would become. A nation that struggles with God throughout the Bible. I mean, throughout the Bible, they are wrestling with God. They follow him faithfully, forget about him, become attached to their possessions, then forget about God and forget about the world that they're meant to be helping, and they just get self-absorbed, and then God sends them out into captivity, and then God eventually brings them back. It starts over, and the cycle just continues. And to be honest, the cycle continues with the people of God, with the spiritual Israel to this day. But later on in the Bible, you know, God will wrestle with a man named Saul. You know, when Paul recounts his encounter, if you will, with God on the road to Damascus, you know, he says that Jesus said to him, "Saul, Saul, it's hard for you to kick against the goads." Saul was fighting back against God. God was trying to move him, trying to get him to go in the right direction. But Saul was very much a wrestler. But eventually he broke. And God changed his name and used him to change the world. You know, you see this pattern throughout the Bible, and we see this pattern in our lives. Now you think about this idea that, man, we often live life devoid of God. We make a mess. God, you know, shatters that reality with the truth of his existence, and he changes us. You know, and if you look at Genesis 33.
Come on.
You know, Jacob gets up and, you know, he's walking with a limp now. Because he's different. Because he's wrestled with God. Not just the way he walked, but the way he'll act. You know, in chapter 32, you see that he sends everyone else ahead and tries to grease the wheels. Verse 1 of 33, Jacob looked up and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two female servants. Put the female servants and their children in front, Leah and her children next. And verse 3, he himself went on ahead. He was a man that his plan prior to wrestling with God is maybe sacrifice everyone else if Esau's really angry and I can get out of here. But after spending the night wrestling with God, you know what? He does separate them so they can get away if things go south. But he runs out in front. He runs out to meet Esau. He runs out to take the brunt of what he perhaps thought he would get from his angry brother. He doesn't start there. He doesn't stop there, though. The text says there in verse 3 that he bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. The birthright, the blessing for the firstborn, all those things he snatched away, he gives back. He puts himself in a servant's position before his brother. He humbles himself before his brother. You know, when Jacob begins to explain what's happened with his life and how he you know, becomes so prosperous, he gives the credit to God, not his shrewdness. He looks back on all those years that he'd been deceiving Laban, and he sees, you know what? Man, God was blessing me. Wasn't because I was super smart. Wasn't because I was really deceptive. It's because God was with me. You know, he tries to make restitution there. You know, he called, you know, his submission is clearly saying, you know, verse 8, verse 13, verse 14, twice. Over and over and over, he calls himself the servant of the Lord, of Esau, putting himself below him. He tries to give back that which he had taken. And here's a man who's radically, radically different. His moral character has changed. Now, if you know the rest of the story, God's not done with him. I mean, a lot of the patterns of his life are going to be played in his sons. You know, and in many ways, I don't know, I look at it and it's almost as if, yes, he's gotten the point, but God's gonna get it deeper and deeper and deeper. Because God's not just, you know, sufficient with a little bit of change. He wants transformation. You know, we are God's workmanship. Right? Paul tells us that in Ephesians 2. He reminds us we are saved by grace through faith. This is not of ourselves. This is not because we're good people, because we're like Jacob. But yet, we are God's workmanship, His handiwork, His great project, that which He is creating and recreating and transforming until He can see Himself so clearly in us. And the challenge for us is to be partners in that process. To not fight against it. To not maybe wrestle all night with Him. But to give in and allow Him to work. In chapter 33, verse 20, you know, there he set up an altar and called it El Eloi Israel, which means God of Israel is mighty, or the God of Israel. It's kind of the pinnacle point, if you will, of his life and the change that's been taking place. His confession that, you know what, God is in control. He is mighty. And again, we're looking at 60 years of a man's life. He's on a journey, trying to do it without God. It's a failure. Realizing God's presence and then being changed by God. And I want to encourage you, align the story of your life with that of Jacob's. If you're living a life that's just honestly producing thorns and thistles in your life, if you're living a life that's just destroying your relationships around you, stop. Yeah. Stop and realize that God is here. He's not distant, He is present. And He wants to be near to you. You know, go to the one who is the pinnacle, the focal point of all God is doing on earth, and that's Jesus. And when you go to Him, He will do with you what He has done with thousands and millions and probably billions of people. And that's change you. Transform you. Take your brokenness and produce character. Take your sin and show you mercy. Take your shortcomings and pour out grace. Take you and use you to be a source of healing as Jacob was with Esau, rather than a source of conflict.
Amen.
You know, as we think about this morning, you know, walking with God, maybe your walk is more like wrestling. Well, take heart. You have company in Jacob. Thanks so much. Let's all stand and sing one final song.